Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It isn't every day we get a chance to talk to a man who has the vast background of experiences that this evening's guest has. Can you imagine, picture yourself in Fairbanks in the year 1905, a little boom city, I guess mostly tents, and a young fellow out on the streets selling Fairbanks' first published paper. We have that newsboy with us this evening. Many of you know him now as a past president of the Pioneers and as a well-known man around town. It's Frank Young. I'd like to introduce him to you now and just find out what it was like selling papers back in those days. What was the name of the paper?
Well, the name of the paper was the Tananaw Miner, and it was published my memory serves me right, in the spring of 1905 by a pioneer by the name of George Bellows.
Well, I should think a man would be pretty brave to tackle a paper up in this country so remote in those days. How did he ever get supplies and equipment?
Well, I at that time was just a little bit too young to know how he got his supplies, but I think they must have come down the Yukon River or up the Yukon by freight in the summertime.
Well, what did the paper cost? What did you do out on the street? Did you call out the paper just like newsboys do now?
That's what we did. We called it out. It cost 25 cents. It was a two-sheeted paper, and we sold them on the streets or what we called streets in those days. Part of some of the streets were stumps, and I think the First and Second Avenue was the only place that there was a little bit of a sidewalk.
Well, of course, up until a few years ago, there hadn't been an appreciable amount of change in that. We're getting it fixed up now. But let me ask you, as a newsboy, how old were you then?
I was about 12.
Well, didn't you run into some pretty tough customers around town, a boy out on the streets? How did people generally treat newsboys?
Well, in those days, they treated the newsboys pretty nice. I never had much difficulty with any real bad characters. I used to sell my papers and enjoy the deal of seeing these miners and gamblers and what have you playing roulette. I remember one time I went into the old Tananaw Saloon and selling my papers, and the bartender told me, "There's a man over there playing roulette. You go over there, he'll buy a paper off you." So I went over and I said, "Tananaw Miner, mister?" And he didn't seem to pay any attention to me. He seemed putting these chips down on the table and what have you, and I asked him two or three times and he didn't answer me, so finally I give him a little pull on the coat and he turned around and said, "How many papers you got?" I said, "Well, I'll count them." I counted out 25 or 30. He bought them all off me and paid me off, and I started away, and he called me back. He says, "Here, boy, now go peddle your papers." He gave me the papers in return.
Well, do you remember, of course you must remember from calling out the headlines every day, what were the headlines, and was it what was going on throughout the world, or was it pretty much confined to right here in this locality?
Well, most of the news was confined, it was local news, because in those days it was hard to get any news of world events. And it was mostly mining, and who was striking it here and who wasn't, and it was all local news, and it was quite interesting to local people, which I suppose the local news is at the present time.
Well, that's very true. We find a great interest in local news. You told me earlier who the man in the Tananaw Saloon was and what he went on to do. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, that gentleman was W.F. Thompson. He later started the News Miner. I think it was in about 1907 or 8. I'm not too positive now, but Mr. W.F. Thompson.
Well, what happened to the old Tananaw Miner, the paper?
Well, that burnt up in the fire of 1906, if I remember right. And then I think the next paper was the Fairbanks Daily Times or the Alaska Citizen. And then later the News Miner.
Mm-hmm. As it is today.
As it is today, yes.
Well, now, in this fire of 1906, that was a pretty big blaze, wasn't it, Mr. Young?
Yeah, that was. It took the all the waterfront property, what the main stores and the places all along the waterfront. That was the main street or main drag at that time, they used to say.
How about your own family? Were you in school then? Was the school affected?
No, the school wasn't affected, no.
Where was the schoolhouse then?
Well, I didn't go to the first little school that was started in Fairbanks, but I went to one of the, I went to the school that used to be located up on 2nd Avenue, we used to call it the Ford Block, where Ray's Parking Services are located at the present time.
An interesting thing that came out of that piece of property within recent months is the hotel corporation attempting to build on it and finding that it was still deeded originally to the town site, put in trust, I guess, for the town site of Fairbanks as a school grounds, playground.
I guess that's right.
And you went to the school, what kind of building? Just a little frame building?
No, it was a frame building, all right, but it wasn't a small one. There's still some of our pioneers here that went to school there with me. There was Charlie Kramer from Kramer's Dairy, and Freddie Johnson, and the Busby Boys, and there might be some others that I just can't recall.
Well, you say you came to Fairbanks in 1905. Where were you before then? Where was your family located?
In Dawson.
What did they, where did they migrate to Dawson from the States?
Yes, ma'am. They come in from Juneau to Dawson. That is 1898-9.
Was your father a miner?
No, my father was in the restaurant business.
Oh, in Dawson?
In Dawson and Fairbanks both. He had a restaurant in Dawson called the Branch Cafe, and he was down here. He had the I can't recall the name of it now. He's pretty young at that time, but I think it was the old model.
Oh. Well, you know, one thing that is particularly interesting, Mr. Young, is you're the first pioneer we've interviewed whose mother, also a pioneer, is still living.
That's right. My mother is living with my sister, Mrs. Husak, out on the farm, and she's 84 years old, and she came into the country as a young woman.
I imagine she has a wealth of stories to tell, doesn't she?
Well, I guess she has if she wished to tell them.
Uh-huh. You used to play in an orchestra, I heard. When was that? Who organized an orchestra here in Fairbanks?
Well, there was quite a number of orchestras here in Fairbanks in the early days. I played with Vic Duran. Everybody knows, or the old-timers, rather, knows Vic Duran. He was quite a violinist around here in the early days. I played with Vic in the first movie theater in Fairbanks, and we used to play the dances at Fox and out at Chattanooga and around the country.
Was that the movie theater up on 4th Avenue, or where was that?
No, that was located right here where the Orpheum is now. It was an old English gentleman by the name of Dick Thorne started it.
Hmm. Gee, I'll bet movies were welcomed with open arms up here, weren't they?
Well, they were what you call the silent films.
Uh-huh. And then you played in the orchestra pit during the movies, that way?
Yes, ma'am. Yes.
I think that's amazing. What did you play, by the way?
Well, I played drums, piano, slide trombone, most anything that I happened to be wanted at. I'm a kind of an all-around musician, or...
Well, I hope to tell you you are. Did you ever try to write music yourself?
Well, yes, I have.
We've been trying to collect some really Alaskan folk songs, and I think you're going to be of some assistance to us along that line.
Well, I hope so.
I'd like to talk a little more about that, but I've been sworn to secrecy, so I won't. Let's go back to the newspaper business for just a moment. And how did you ever get into any other end of the paper business besides just the distributing of it?
Yes, I used to work down at the old Times, as in them days they used to call it the printer's devil. I used to mix the, collect the lead and melt it and sweep the floors and pick up the papers and stack paper and what have you around the plant.
That was the printing plant. For which paper was this?
That was the old Times. It was located down on First Avenue, down just the other side of, let me see now, everything's changing so fast around here, I can't keep up with these places. You see a place one day, the next day something else is there. It kind of confuses me. But anyway, it's right below the Odd Fellows Hall there, just below the library. There's a building, and the next building, that's where the Old Times Publishing Company was located.
Well, it seems to me, Mr. Young, that a lot of the early day, the sort of the center of culture was down in that end of town, wasn't it? On the other side of Cushman, they got their library down there, and...
Well, quite a lot of it. That was all built up. The old Pioneer Hotel was in there in them days, and the old California saloon, which took in a whole block, and many old landmarks that was built 1903, 1904, and 1905. They're all gone now, but that used to be pretty much the main part of town down mm-hmm. in there.
I understand that once a stateside newspaper did hit Fairbanks, that it really was pretty well rumpled up before it was finally ever destroyed. What about news from the outside? How often did you get it?
Well, we used to get outside papers. That'd be Seattle PI and San Francisco Examiner about once a month or once every 6 weeks, and we'd sell them on the streets for a dollar apiece.
You'd sell them in addition to your local papers?
Yes, ma'am.
Huh. What about some of the other things that have happened to you up here? You never went out and mined, did you?
Yes, I did a little mining, much to my sorrow. I never... got in what you might call in the money, but I have did some mining, and I've taken in most stampedes around the country, down Ruby, up over into Koyukuk, and into the Shoshana, and down the Iditarod, and down Marshall, and around the country all over.
Well, in all of your travels, you no doubt have met a great many of the old timers who've really been recorded in worldwide history. I'd like particularly to talk about Jack London for a moment, because you did mention him before we went on the air in connection with a poem that he wrote.
Yeah, I never met Jack London, but I met and talked with Burning Daylight, mm-hmm. which Jack London wrote the book, Burning Daylight, and I knew Burning Daylight. His right name was, correct name was Elam Harnish. And I used to go in and talk to Elam quite a lot. And I asked him one day, where did Jack London get this, where did he get his inspiration to write this story, Burning Daylight, and you have the name now? Well, he says, Frank, I'll tell you. We was coming into Dawson in spring of 98, and he said we was camped on a 30-mile river. And he said, I used to get up just at daylight. He said, you know, London was a younger man than I am, and he used to like to sleep in. So I'd have to wake him up and say, come on now, London, get up. You're burning daylight laying there. You're burning daylight. And he'd roll out. So it wasn't long after that Elam Harnish was nicknamed Burning Daylight by Jack London. So that's how the how Jack London got the idea of Burning Daylight. Of course, the story, and a part of the story, is that he added to it is quite a story.
It certainly is. Well, it's just too bad that we can't have the life history of all of Alaska's pioneers down in black and white for posterity, because there is no more vivid, colorful, or interesting group of people anywhere. That's my honest opinion. I do want to thank Frank Young, past president of the Pioneers, for being with us today and for telling us some of his extremely interesting experiences in the Northland.
Celebration of the VJ Day by the Thunder Army Eskimos at Nome, Alaska, August 14, 1945. The celebration is in the big native school. The Eskimos are dressed in their native parkies and muckalucks. I would estimate well over 300 natives, with a sprinkling of whites, are already jammed in this hall. The Eskimo drummers are sitting on the floor, each with a big, large skin drum. Every square inch of the floor space is occupied except a small space in the front of the drummers where the dancers will dance. Chief John Aularana of the King Island Eskimos is now speaking in Eskimo. I believe he is conferring a native name on the major. The next voice you'll hear will be that of Major Marston. This is Buzz Walters announcing. We are gathered here in Nome, Alaska, to celebrate a very great occasion, VJ Day, victory over the Japs and the end of the long war. Let us pay respect to those brave soldiers who gave their lives that we might be free. And right here, let me say to the everlasting glory and credit of the Eskimo people, every able-bodied Eskimo from 16 to 65 is a member of the Thunder Army or of the regular army. 4 years ago, when I first met you, dark, threatening clouds hung over the nation. White men and Eskimos alike were disturbed, not knowing just what course to take. The Japs bombed Dutch Harbor, landed on Attu and Kiska Island. Enemy submarines lurked in the waters of the Bering Sea, and we were still unorganized and unarmed. I called on you in the name of the President of the United States and of the Governor of Alaska to organize, to arm, to prepare to defend your home, your children, and your women. Every able-bodied Eskimo joined on first call. A record no group of people in Alaska, or the world for that matter, can equal. I salute you, the Thunder Army, for what you have done and for the friendly, cooperative spirit you have shown in your willingness to do your part in defending the shores of Alaska. The Thunder Army successfully met the Jap balloon attack, and for efficient service rendered in shooting down Jap balloons, recovering same, and promptly reporting to the United States Army, were cited in a letter from the General of the Alaska Department for alertness and efficiency. General Gaffney sent a letter citing the APG company at Ruby on the Yukon for alertness in recovering a pilot who had parachuted from a disabled plane. The Thunder Army broke hundreds of miles of trail through the Arctic wilderness of Alaska, repaired 60 shelter cabins, put out many fires caused by incendiary bombs from Jap balloons, built 20 Kashim armories, held weekly drills and competitive rifle shoots, and all this without pay. You have proved your loyalty and patriotism. You were happy to be Uncle Sam warrior, and I have been proud to be your leader. Let us continue to work together for peace and prosperity. I pray God to bless you and keep you, and may you have plenty muktuk, akutuk, mikiuk, and titmuk. This is my wish for you, men of the tundra, brave, courteous, happy people. I will not say goodbye, but in the language of the Kopuk Eskimo, ilat negasuli, meaning sometime again. I shall remember you always, and think of you as one great artist forever. Ilat Negasuli. Following is a record of King Island Eskimo music and dance made at Nome, Alaska on VJ Day. This is Buzz Walters making a record for Major Marston of the Eskimo dance and music.
Here's a pioneer. Once again, one of the pioneer transportation firms of Interior Alaska, the Pioneer Cab Company, is pleased to bring you 15 minutes of remembrance. Joe Coble and the Pioneer Cab staff hope you'll enjoy the following interview with a genuine old-timer. His name is E.H. Stroker, prominent local banker. Mr. Stroker, I'm going to begin this interview by asking you about your family home in the States. Where was it located?
It was located in San Francisco, California.
When and why did you decide to come to the territory of Alaska?
Well, I was young, and my mother thought it'd be a good idea if I would get away from home. No one had ever left home. And she thought that I would appreciate my home after my return from this venture.
Well, I can understand her logic there, all right. Will you tell us something of your trip to Alaska? The year was 1900.
1900. We left in April, the 19th day of April. And it took us about 35 days to the minute to get to Dutch Harbor. During this time, we had encountered many storms and calms. And so that we had a very enjoyable trip, although it was rather a rugged one. And in Dutch Harbor, we stayed there for some time, as it was impossible to get up to Nome due to the ice that was flowing at that time.
Were there any particular incidents on the trip that seemed to stick in your memory?
Oh, yes. One time in the calm, there was another young fellow and myself. We dove off of the ship and swam around that, and we had the pleasure of swimming in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And during our stay in Dutch Harbor, I had been a professional ball player, or semi-professional, and when they saw me play the first game, why, they insisted on us staying for several days to help out. And there were a great number of ships, the Zealandia and Ohio, and crafts of all descriptions were going to Nome.
Will you tell us something about Dutch Harbor of 1900?
Well, it was the harbor was just filled up with ships, as I say, and gambling was going at full blast. It was the first time that I had ever seen any gambling of that kind, and it was a country that one would not care to live in, as they had such a poor climate. There, and all at once a willy wall come along, that is a gust of wind that comes suddenly, and it just made waves 10, 20 feet high.
I imagine you didn't stay in Dutch Harbor very long then.
Not any longer than these people wanted. They asked our captain if they wouldn't stay over a few days to let me play ball with them.
I see. How long did it take you to get from Dutch Harbor to Nome?
Well, we'd never reached Nome. We started from Dutch Harbor and went along the peninsula and stopped in Henrene Bay in Port Muller. And there we saw some Indians that were living in cliffs. They were very poor, and it was quite a game country. Lots of ducks and caribou and bear, and all kinds of clams and other things there. We stayed there for a while and kept going on and took in most all the rivers along in Bristol Bay. Finally landed up at Good News Bay, and then from Good News Bay we went into the Kuskokwim, and we went as far as the Ick River. From there, three of us went in a small Whitehall boat to Bethel. At Bethel we met Dr. Romig, and also the collector of census at that time. And then Dr. Kilbuck, a Cherokee Indian who was a missionary from the Moravian Mission, was going up river to take census. So we went along with him in this Peterborough canoe about 650 miles. We went up to the Stony River and the Yellow River, and then back on down. And then from there we went, got our own schooner, and went back to Dutch Harbor and on through to Frisco.
I see, and I imagine having once tasted Alaska at the turn of the century, you certainly intended to return. Did it take you very long before you decided to come back to the territory?
Well, I had a position open in the Hawaiian Islands as an accountant, but I passed that up to come back up. I had the fever for the north, and I went into Valdez. And in the spring of the year, we went over the Valdez Glacier. We got caught on there for 4 days, and we were snowed in. And I don't think I ever ate as much dog hair as I did then. And we finally made it over after it calmed down, and we mined in there in the summer. And when we got back in the fall, my partner left and went to the outside, and I stuck it out. I stayed in Valdez, and the second spring I went into Slate Creek, and then come back in the fall. And in the spring of 1903, after the big strike of the Nazina country, why, I went in there with another fellow, Adolph Smith, and a couple of horses, and we had a lay on some ground, and we worked that, but it was there was not much in the ground, so there was a fellow staked us to go over onto the headwaters of the White River. I had 9 head of horses, and another fellow who had 2 mules, Bob Fulkerson, and myself, we did the packing over there all summer until in the first part of November, the last part of October. And we wintered, there were 5 of us, wintered in the headwaters of the White River that winter. Then we went back to the Nazina in the spring and worked all summer. And in the fall, I packed over to the headwaters of the Shoshana River. And knowing the glaciers of the Scoli, the Frederica, and the Nazina, why, I guided 14 people over there. Well, at the head of the river, why, we whipsawed lumber and built a boat and come down the Shoshana in the fall of the year, arriving here in Fairbanks on the 4th day of October.
Was that your first time in Fairbanks?
That was the first time in Fairbanks. There was possibly 15,000 people and maybe 20,000 dogs. I don't know. It seemed that many dogs. They were all over the sidewalks and streets.
I understand there was a lot of activity in the outlying creeks at that time, too.
Yes, there was. The creeks just looked like a harbor with all the poles sticking up. It looked like masts sticking up all along on Clary and all of the other creeks.
Well, Mr. Stroker, we're certainly interested in what sort of work you did here in Fairbanks before you got into the banking business. Would you tell something of that?
Well, I was sort of up against it when I got here, so I dug the foundation in December for the California Saloon.
I'd say you'd have to be up against it to dig your foundation in December.
That was a very hard digging, and it was hard on the hands. Then after that, I went to the creeks, and I finally got a job with Swiftwater Bill mining underground, and I stayed with that for some time. Then I run the water wagon for Jack Brazil for a time while he was on his jamboree, and after that I quit and I stampeded into the Cantishner and staked some ground there. And on my return to Fairbanks, why, R.A. Jackson, the surveyor, was then to survey the Chattanooga River for Mr. Murphy, who was prominent in the Murphy Ditch survey, Murphy Ditch in Nome. And so I went out with them and stayed until June. And then I helped the packer to pack in the mules to Fairbanks. After we arrived in Fairbanks, why, then I went up river with 2 fellows, and we cut logs, dry wood, and we brought down about the largest raft of wood that was ever brought into Fairbanks. 110 feet long it was.
And that was for the local mill to cut into lumber?
No, that was for stove wood. That was 16-foot wood, which was sold for wood in town.
Oh, I see.
And upon my arrival in town, why, Ike Loomis, who was then the superintendent of the roads for the that is under Mr. Zug, was about to start on slashing a road, a winter road from here to the Delta, and he was looking for me, and he asked me if I wanted to go to work, so he sent me out to the Tananaw, and I cooked for the crew there for about 4 days, after which he got 5 head of horses, and then I was the packer for the outfit until the 1st of October. And then when we got back into Fairbanks, the Clough Kinghorn and Loomis had the mail contract, and so he sent me in a small boat with Fred Date down to Tananaw. We picked up our dogs and sled and fish on the way down, and before we got there, we were frozen, and we had to sled part of the way to Tananaw, and we waded across the Tananaw River until the ice stopped running. It stopped at 7 o'clock at night, and we crossed the next morning early with big poles and so on, and we had to report there for the mail.
I can imagine a project like that would call for a lot of hardship.
Well, it was that it snowed for 3 days steady. That's what froze the river up at that time.
I suppose about that time you were ready to sort of settle down in town then, weren't you?
Well, no, I kept at that all winter long. That was about the coldest winter that we ever had. And after that, I got into various other things, and I finally got to work for E.R. Peoples, where I was for about 11 years.
He ran a store?
He run the store where the Nordale Hotel is now. And after he sold out, then Mr. Wood got me to come to the bank.
I see. And did you particularly like the banking business? What did you do in the bank? What was your first job?
Well, my first job was in the teller window. And in 3 months, I was the head teller. And in 6 months, I was a cashier of the bank.
Well, the story that you've told us here tonight, Mr. Stroker, is certainly interesting and varied. And it proves to us that you've certainly covered a lot of territory since the first time that you came to Alaska back in 1900. I'm wondering if you, as a real old-time pioneer, have ever felt any feeling of regret in regard to coming here. Do you begrudge the time that you've spent in Alaska, the major part of your lifetime?
I get a great pleasure in going back over the different things that have happened in the past, and I have great hopes of things going ahead in the future. And my children are here, and they will stay here, and I have all of my interest here, and I have no idea of leaving the country at any time at all.
Do you share the feeling of many of the pioneers who endured the hardships of the early days to the effect that Alaska, its transportation and communication being much improved, is a far more comfortable place in which to live now than it was in the early days, and so as time goes on, it will become even more habitable and will be more hospitable, we might say?
I certainly do.
Uh-huh. Well, we certainly appreciate your coming. I wonder if you have... We have a few seconds left here, Mr. Stroker. If you have anything else to say to your many Alaskan friends, perhaps the old-timers, now would certainly be the time to do it.
Well, I don't have it.
I can see that that would call for some thought, and there are many, many things that you would possibly like to say if you had a little time to think it over. Well, thank you, Mr. E.H. Stroker. Friends, you've listened to Here's a Pioneer, the weekly 15-minute broadcast that brings before the microphone one of Alaska's early day pioneers who helped to make history in the territory. Each Wednesday evening at 7:30, the Pioneer Cab Company, an old-timer among Fairbanks businesses, brings you this 15 minutes of radio recollection. Joe Coble and the Pioneer Cab Company invite you to listen to Here's a Pioneer again next week.